Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project, where we look at two films from the A24 filmography every 2 weeks. This week, we're bringing you another In Between Films interview, and I'm joined by writer and director Azazel Jacobs. Azazel was the writer and director of The Lovers, the second ever movie after Moonlight for A24 to help produce from the start. The Lovers sees Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts playing a long-married, dispassionate couple who are both in the midst of serious affairs. But on the brink of calling it quits, a spark between them suddenly reignites, leading them to an impulsive romance. Azazel talks to me about coming from a filmmaking family, his early career, short films, and making the step up to features. Azazel shares what it was like to help write and direct the popular Sky Atlantic and HBO series Doll and M before working with A24 on The Lovers, and how they supported the film, encouraged his creative vision, and the release of the film, and much more. Thanks to Azazel for joining me, and I hope you enjoy your interview. Me and Dallas will return next week with Oasis Supersonic and The Munster. Till then, enjoy this bumper interview. Thanks for listening.
I always love to find out what kind of inspired people to pursue sort of filmmaking as a career. What inspired you to take the leap?
I grew up in Lower Manhattan. Both my parents are artists. My father, Ken Jacobs, is an experimental filmmaker. So he's been making underground experimental films since the late 50s. So really, film was very, very much part of the house. It was always there. And it was always something that I took as an important and worthy course in life. I think early on, I really planned on being more of a cartoonist is what my idea was. I loved comic books, and especially a lot of like the underground comic book or an influence, and so I thought that that would be something that I would head towards, but I wound up at around, I think, 17, around my last year of high school, picking up a Super 8 camera that was in the house, and that was kind of one of the things that really made that that path there, is that there was cameras and film kind of around the house, so I could pick one up and try it out, and really found myself enjoying just shooting friends in high school, I guess the way that they're doing with nowadays.
What were those sort of early films like that you shot with your friends and family?
The Super 8 was black and white. It was it really was, I think, exactly what I imagine young people are doing today. Just people hanging out, walking through the hallways of school. You know, the difference was obviously that we had these like 2.5 minutes, you know, for each reel. So you were just kind of doing short bursts of things, just little quick moments of catching memories, which now has only become more valuable when I've seen that work, because it's really like a completely lost time. A lot of friends that I no longer know, and a city that really barely is recognizable to the one that is today. But it wasn't with those intentions. It was really just to capture the moment, which just wound up becoming more important as time has gone on.
Was there any sort of films in your youth that helped you with your journey, ones that were inspiring you outside of your kind of family as well?
There were some films. I did grow up watching a lot of underground films and filmmakers that would come to the house to show movies, and that would always have, and you know, that had a weight to it, especially the conversations that would happen like late into the night afterwards, because there was really no money and no recognition in this world. So the conversations were kind of the pay after each screening, and they would go on for many, many hours, and they'd get heated, and they'd get, they'd get loud, but they were always, they had a big impact, and just feeling the honesty of the conversation. So that was one thing. And then I think that there were movies that the family, I mean, we'd watch a lot of early films from the 30s and 40s. Those were very important to us. I think one film that I really loved a lot was called Hell's a Poppin', which I think is very hard to reach. Hard to get now. I think there's some copyright issues, but it's kind of like, if you can imagine Mad Magazine on film, it was that. It's just completely anarchy, and it breaks the third wall, and it talks straight to the camera. It does all sorts of amazing things in that film, and it kind of showed me somewhat of the possibilities of film. I think another film that had a big impact as a young person was Robert Altman's Popeye that I went to see in the theater. Definitely the bigger, like, Aliens. I remember that having, you know, I mean, these are films that we talked about and thought about. Popeye, and I think around when VHS was more possible. And so that's one of the films that I remember seeing kind of quite a bit growing up. I'm trying to think of what other works, but that's what's coming to mind right now between Hell's a Poppin' and Popeye and just the experimental filmmakers that were around the home. And Brockage and Jonas Mekas and Ernie Gehr, people like that.
Was there a pressure when you sort of decided to pursue a career in filmmaking that, you know, you've got your mother and your father are great and talented filmmakers? Was there a pressure to match them, or were they sort of fully encouraging of you to get out there and forge your own career?
I didn't feel the pressure. I didn't know if there was a pressure. I think that, again, my idea was that I would try to go to an art college for fine arts. I didn't get into any, but I did get into a film school, a film department of SUNY Purchase, which is a small state school in upstate New York. And again, my idea was I'll go up there for 1 year, and then I'll try to switch out into doing something with fine arts. The SUNY Purchase turned out to be a really small film department, and I just didn't understand what they would be asking, how much they were asking. And really from the first day of going there, they really ask you every day, is this something that you want to do? And the more that they asked me that in their own ways, the more I realized that this was something that I really wanted to pursue. I just fell in love with learning about film, especially coming from not really understanding at all how narrative films were put together, not understanding how they were cut together, not understanding how some scenes were covered, you know, and all these different angles and different times and shot out of order, and then finding out that they're put together and like magic, suddenly we were in this moment. So that opened a big path for me. And also I hadn't seen really the independent films until going to SUNY Purchase. That was really the first time that I got to see be introduced to Strange in Paradise and Jarmusch and all these kind of films that I guess I should have known, but I just really didn't. And said, okay, there's a path between experimental films and narrative films, both of which I like. There's something right in the middle between the two with independent films. Say that I definitely felt pressure, you know, showing my film, my work to my parents was high pressure because I you know, on one side you want them to like the work, and at this other side I want them to, you know, I want it to be very different. But I very quickly realized that I had an interest in stories way beyond narrative stories that my parents didn't. And that gave me a totally different world to kind of work in.
You worked on sort of a range of short films sort of between the late 90s and the early 2000s. What were sort of your memories on working on those shorts?
Well, the most important of those films is called Kirk and Carrie. And that was my senior thesis film out in 1996. It was finished by 1996. If anybody's interested, they can go to a website that I have and they can watch it for free. It's about 26 minutes. The website is talkiesinc.com. And the short is called Kirk and Carrie. And what that was a story about a young couple that were both actors and trying to deal with playing lovers on a fictional film that was being made on a soundstage and also being real lovers in real life. And I wound up casting an actual couple as well of two actors that were truly in a relationship. And so having that space, that third area to explore outside of the script was something that I had a lot of fun with. And a lot of it, just again, I think, which is still my obsession, which is how to find truth in film, and whether that's by recognizing that it's a film and where to recognize it as the mechanics. And those are the movies that I kind of most gravitate towards. Is the ones that recognize their limits as is filmed, the frame lines, all those things, and use it to kind of be hopefully more honest with how they're delivering their stories.
Was it always your aim when you were making these short films to graduate to sort of feature films, or was it one of these ones that you were still sort of testing, is this something I want to do as a career?
Well, career is, you know, I'm 17, 18, 19 years old, so it's just really hard to think of anything career-wise. I definitely didn't think very far ahead. I was making this work, I was living my life, I was growing up. Also, the city was becoming much more expensive. New York City was becoming much more expensive during this period, and trying to figure out how to make it as a filmmaker and pay rent. And it was just a very, very different thing than what my parents had to deal with when rent was so cheap and you could kind of at least put work above, at least until you had a family, you could put your filmmaking work above the rent. But that's what drew me to going out, moving out to Los Angeles and with that and going to graduate school, is because I really realized that while Purchase was incredible at bringing out, like, that I had something to say and ways that I could say it, when it came down to actually writing a feature script, which is then what I started getting really interested in and wanting to tell a full story, I really didn't know how to do it, at least in the narrative constructs that I was hoping to. And so that drew me to applying to the American Film Institute with that short film, Kirk and Carrie, and luckily I was accepted. And that if anything, yeah, I had the desire, but that kind of gave me the drive much more to tell these stories full.
What was the experience of going to school like? Because you hear some sort of filmmakers go, you know what, I could learn everything outside of the school. But for some, it's truly helped them get their career going. What was your sort of school experience like?
I think that's exactly true what you said. I think that it's what I needed. I really did not know how to do this. I did want to make it my living. I did want to be able to pay my rent doing what I loved. I needed to learn some rules, and I needed to learn even the rules that I was going to break or push against. I felt like I needed to know the limitations and some of the structures. I was definitely realizing that a lot of the films that I was going back to, whether it was Breathless or any of these, like these filmmaker or Cassavetes, you know, like I understood that they really understood structure, and it was their understanding of it allowed them to kind of break so many of these rules and push against it and find these spaces in between. So for me, film school, and especially AFI at that time, was the right thing for that. I just wanted to know, okay, so generally in telling a story, this happens within the first 10 minutes and this goes on and learning how to work with people and understanding about permits, all these kind of things that I know it's not necessary for every filmmaker, and there's been so many incredible filmmakers that just did not need to learn that. And I saw, even in my class, how film school could be wrong for some filmmakers, how it really took away and hurt some of what they already had. But this was something that I didn't. I had the desire, and I had something innate, I think, to tell, but finding some words for it, or how to use these words, was something that I needed from school, which I was able to get. I would just add that on top of that, I wound up being in a class of really fellow strong filmmakers that, and we've at least a few of us, we've continued to lean on each other and continue to work on each other. My cinematographer, Tobias Dadam, who shot everything since 2007, I mean, really everything. He was at AFI. He was a year below me, but it was him shooting my fellow filmmaker's first feature that made me look at his work and go, okay, this is somebody I would love to try working with. And that's Barnett, you know, turned into a wonderful collaboration.
Your first sort of feature came and Nobody Needs to Know. What was it like to, as you were saying, that challenge of writing a feature-length script earlier, what was it like to deliver a feature-length film in the end and produce one?
Well, that Actually, it was writing that script that I realized that I needed AFI. I'd been working on that script after Kirk and Carrie over and writing it and over and over and over again for years, really. Just constantly going back to it and trying to figure out how to write a full-length script. So I wound up going to AFI. I realized that it was pushing me and teaching me these very, very narrative ways of filmmaking. I felt that as a balance to it, I should try making this script on weekends that nobody needs to know on weekends and on summer breaks. And so I wound up shooting that film in between school while I was going to the best that I could. So we started on summer break and I shoot weekends and I continued on after school and just kind of piecing it together, very, very small budget and with a very, very small crew. So oddly, it was almost simultaneous that I was making that. And that was, you know, it's a black and white video, semi-narrative film that finished soon after graduating. And that film shaped me in huge ways. I mean, it's a big story to go into, but I guess what I could tell you is that the film premiered at Rotterdam in 2003, and it was the first film of mine, you know, first feature, and I finished it. Really, I was able to send them a work, you know, almost close to finished cut, and it got accepted. But I hadn't seen it with an audience until that first screening at the Rotterdam Film Festival, and it became very clear after 5 minutes that the film was not going to be a hit with the audience. I mean, it really emptied out the theater very quickly, and it was a huge hit in a lot of ways. You know, the first thing I got from it really was a long review just saying, you know, how terrible it was and how terrible a filmmaker I was and how little of a future I had. And so those are things that you, especially I think with the first cut, you know, it shapes you in some ways. It definitely shaped what I was, the next film that I called A Good Times Kid.
One of the films I was curious about from your early filmography was Mama's Man, and obviously you cast your parents in the leading role. What was it like to work with family on a feature film? What was that whole experience like?
Well, I guess it goes back. Mama's Man is kind of goes back to Kirk and Carrie in the way of casting, you know, actual people to play roles and trying to find some way that no matter what you're looking at, no matter what somebody's saying, there's some truth to the moment. Mama's Man is a story about a young man in his 30s that goes and visits his parents, and he has a young family back in California, and so he visits his parents in New York City, and basically kind of bit by bit moves back into his childhood bedroom and comes up with a lot of excuses why he shouldn't return to his own family. It's definitely a personal story. It definitely came from the visiting my folks and realizing, like, wow, this is so nice to be back here and to wake up and to have breakfast and coffee, waiting, and it just to be mothered again. And why did I ever leave? And that kind of joke started off me writing something, and I wound up writing for the home that I was raised in Lower Manhattan, but the more that I did that, the more I realized that I couldn't separate that place with my parents. And so as I started writing about putting my parents in those roles, I also started writing about a very different person than myself, realizing that I could be a lot more honest if I wrote a fictional version of their son rather than the way that I perceived myself, because I didn't trust myself or not was a way to kind of contrast the truth and fiction and make believe that is kind of inherent in cinema.
kind of following that, sort of Terry came along, which was sort of a real big hit for you at the time. What was that like? It seemed to be sort of all your hard work seemed to kind of pay off in this film, you know, this critically acclaimed film. You've got someone like John C. Reilly. What was it like, sort of Terry all coming together for you? Did it feel like sort of a real high in your early career?
I don't know how honest this sounds, but really each of these films have felt like a complete breakthrough for me, because have been able to make films the way that I've had a lot of control over. And that's ultimately been my biggest aim, is that whatever flaws or whatever is in there, I can at least say that they're my fault and not something I can't blame anybody else for. So with Good Times Kid, Mama's Man definitely for me was the first film that I would say, you know, really, like, in terms of like a critical reception and finding Stern real passionate lovers of, that had a big impact on me, and that definitely what laid the ability to make Terry. If anything, I think there was a success to Mama's Man that made me want to push the opposite direction and tell something else very different than what I'd done, because I felt like, oh, if I could keep making films like this, which would do very well at festivals and critically, and I want to go into a different direction. It did come together in a really, you know, an interesting and great way. John C. Reilly had seen Mama's Man and at a film festival, and I wound up speaking. His wife, Allison Dickey, had seen Kirk and Carrie back then at a festival back when that first happened. So I've been in a relationship and talking with her since like 1997. So she had wound up bringing John C. Reilly to Mama's Man, and I was speaking to him afterwards, and he cared for the film. And it was right around then that Patrick DeWitt had shared with me the short story that Terry was to become. And so speaking to John, I went, oh man, he would be perfect as one, the main character, the kind of guidance, one of the main characters of the guidance counselor, Mr. Fitzgerald. So there was a momentum from Mama's Man that carried on to the making of Terry. It was, by that point, I had kind of had this relationship with a few. I had found my editor through Mama's Man. I had found my cinematographer. I started finding my key crew that I was able to carry on over to Terry, including my composer, a bunch of people, actually. So I felt like a continuation, and I still felt insulated. Definitely having a film going out into theaters in a wider way than Terry was a great experience. But also, you know, with all these things comes the, you know, the other side of it, which was, I think it wound up bringing less an audience than distributors hoped. You know, all those things that you kind of, you try to put on your shoulders, you definitely feel things.
I sort of first came to know of you as a filmmaker sort of about maybe 5-6 years ago. I was at a Q&A event for Emily Mortimer at the Edinburgh Film Festival, and she was talking about this show that she was working on, Doll and M. How did sort of for you this transition to getting involved as sort of a writer-director on this HBO television show come around, and how did they reach out to you perhaps to get involved in this?
Well, believe it or not, Dolly and Emily are both in Nobody Needs to Know. So it kind of circles back to me making that film while I was at AFI. I wound up meeting Dolly, who had a friend that was going out with a friend of mine. So she came by one of my sets that I was shooting, you know, like one of the school projects. And we got on really well. And then I wound up meeting Emily. So this is around 2000, I believe. So our relationship had kind of begun, for my relationship with the two of them had begun a while back. And so every time I would go to London to show a film, or they'd come to New York, or however it was work, we'd wind up connecting and showing each other and talking to each other about work. So I wound up going to the London Film Festival with Terry, I believe in 2011, and saw Dolly, and she told me about this idea that her and Emily were working on, thinking that it was going to be more for a play about them, you know, Dolly becoming a personal assistant to Emily. And this is right after I had seen Joseph Losey's The Servant and was just kind of thoroughly obsessed with the film. And so when she mentioned this, I totally saw the connection between those two. And it was also, you know, just 2011, so I think Louis was just showing up. There's some incredible TV that was still very early on, but it felt like a completely open path and terrain. So I wound up, during the kind of promoting of Terry, writing Dolly and Emily and saying, hey, I totally respect this is your idea. I, you know, like, if you're going to do it as a play, that's great. But, you know, it could also potentially be a great TV thing as well. And they both responded positively. And we wound up just very quickly sketching together what would become our first episode. And then Dolly flew over to LA, and we wound up shooting the very first episode of Dolly and M. I think it was around 2011, maybe 2012, just for ourselves, just to see if we have something. And we did it super, super cheap. I mean, really just Toby, my cinematographer, me, Dolly and Emily, Darren, my editor, there's another woman, Stacy Peters, and there's I'm talking about like four or five of us using Emily's, like, the backdrop of the newsroom. So like the trail that we shot in her trailer in between while she was shooting the show, the newsroom, doing these other things. It's kind of what I learned from shooting Nobody Needs to Know and shooting Good Times Kid, and like Mama's Man, very scrappy way of shooting, but just really just for ourselves. We cut that into a 19-minute thing and really liked it. And that's what we wound up showing to Sky and getting a series order. And actually that turned into our first episode. So if you watch Dawn M, you'll see, I mean, no one really noticed that the jump was from like this first episode that may have cost a few hundred dollars to something quite a bit bigger, which I think is the testament to the spirit of the piece that's continuing on, and that's kind of how that began. It really was, almost like a stumble forward without anything kind of pragmatic.
What were sort of the challenges of working in sort of television, and what was it like to be able to work on an HBO series? Because I suppose when we think of television, we think of some things a bit more smaller scale, but with something like HBO, it's almost like every, whether it's a comedy or a TV show, every single thing that they put out feels like a mini movie in a way. What was that like for you, that whole experience?
Well, we approached it exactly like a film. Again, I carried over the same crew from Mama's Man and then Terry straight into this. So really I was surrounded with exactly by this point, a very tight film crew. And we took it just as seriously. We really didn't, it didn't feel like anything very different in that way. Other than that first season, we were able to shoot each episode out, which was a different way of, so there, in some ways, there was a continuity to it all that you don't get with film when you're going from shooting the beginning to the middle to the end and just jumping around within every day. There was, within each episode, it was pretty straightforward, which was something that I really embraced. I loved about shooting episodically in that way. I would say, because this was the first show that Sky was selling to HBO, so all our notes that and people that we really worked closely with were from Sky Television in the UK, and they were wonderful to work with. They were just really supportive. This was a small show for them, but they so what I mean is, like, they didn't micromanage, but they were really, I think they saw this similar thing that we wanted to make, and so I always felt like whatever ideas, whatever notes they had was really conducive to what we were trying to do. And so I don't know if I felt really, it didn't feel very different other than until the show came out. That was such a suddenly have the show out and not to be sitting with an audience, really having a very a different idea of what feedback was. You know, I was just much more used to kind of going into touring with a film, with a festival, sitting with and seeing what was resonating, what wasn't, feeling things out, and then suddenly to have it out into people's homes and let them have their individual experience was something for me to get used to. But I definitely felt also at that time TV was still kind of being disregarded. I think this is kind of pre, or maybe what they didn't really weren't calling the golden age of TV yet. I'm not saying that Dylan M was part of the golden age, but definitely felt there was still this thing that I don't think exists anymore, which is it wasn't taken as serious because it was a movie. It wasn't a movie where we took it, you know, the exact same seriousness to it.
Following Dahl and M, the Lovers came along. What was the origin of the script and the story for you?
Well, it was one of those things where I was like carrying around a sense, like I'm always kind of jotting things in a notebook, and I had been carrying around a sentence about a couple that cheat on their lovers with each other, and I just had that sentence for a good couple of years and didn't go any more with that. And then I think I realized suddenly after doing two seasons of Dylan M and really approaching it, like I said, very handmade, and suddenly it was 4 years gone and I hadn't made a film for that long, I believe. I mean, I think it was even longer by the time I finished The Lovers. But at that point, I realized, like, oh, this huge chunk of time I've been putting towards this show, and I just kind of stepped away. And then I started realizing some things that were different about what a film was to TV and how to just have something that just didn't have to go on. I think that was something that I was really attracted to going back to films. And filmmaking and making a feature. So I had that drive. I was looking at that story. I was going through some personal situations where a good friend and mentor and teacher and collaborator named Gil Dennis, that had been my teacher at AFI, had suddenly and unexpectedly passed away. So I was dealing with a bunch of grief from that, and my dog of 16 years was also in the midst of dying, and somehow that one sentence I wound up having above my page and just writing about this couple, I think I could feel that it was a story that Gil would have really enjoyed, and so there was some weird way of when I was writing it, and the more I wrote it, the more I felt like I was suddenly back in conversation with somebody who I couldn't talk to suddenly. And that's where it began, you know. So it's odd. It's not, it's not my story in terms of like, I am been long time married. I don't have kids. That's not my life. I don't really know where the story came from. I don't really question it. Maybe I'll have a better understanding of where that story comes from in many years from now. But that the real drive of it was just to kind of continue, you know, a conversation that had been interrupted with a close friend.
Was it challenging as a young man like yourself to get into the mindset of an older couple who have lived through such a long relationship together, or do you draw from your own experiences and those around you?
It was fun, interesting. My way in was definitely the boy, the kind of the ex super sensitive boy, you know, their son, you know, who's played by Tyler Ross. Like, I think that was my, I remember very much that first feeling like, oh, you're being lied to by adults, and just what kind of bullshit world this was, and you just wanted to tear it all down. And even though my parents were very honest and very, you know, like, and very truthful, that there's that moment as a young person where you realize how much bullshit you're being surrounded by and how infuriating that is. And so I think my way in was through Joel, that character. Through the writing of it, I think going through experiences and relationships, I also understand how relationships are complicated and simple, and how it's kind of, I do have a different view on it in terms of judging relationships. And now I think that was the other thing that was going on, is like, I was watching a few close friends and close relationships break up, and it was very hard for me to go like, okay, so that love didn't exist, it did exist, it's no longer exists, it's just confusing. And so the writing of it came from a place of really kind of watching these characters go than judging them so much and just seeing what they do and trying to be honest to their path.
At what stage does someone like A24 get involved? Because at this stage of their filmography, they were known for distributing films, not producing films. How did they come to produce your film? You know, you're one of the earliest ones that they produced. How did that come around?
A24 was getting a thing, and they were just going to start financing small films at that point. And so I think we just had heard about Moonlight. I mean, Moonlight hadn't shot yet when we started the conversation with them. And that was the first film up, and we were the second. And what happened is we sent out the script to, you know, a few different people, a few different companies. And the script resonated. Like, and suddenly there was quite a bit of interest. A24 responded very, very fast, very, very positively. They liked my work, and they really appreciated the script. And it just it wound up becoming between another company and them. And the other company offered a lot, many times. Kind of, they started off many times the budget that A24 did, but A24 offered an amazing amount of control with this project that the other company didn't. So it was a really easy choice for me. Like, they took 1 minute when I asked for certain things in terms of having Final Cut, and they said, absolutely, that's yours. That meant so much to me. And that's how that began. And I got to say that, like, even my first conversation with Tracy Letts, when we're talking about him being in the part, in the role, I know that A24 just have, by that point, so I didn't bring on any actors, even though, you know, Dip Winger had left Terry and emailing kind of throughout the years, but I really hadn't brought any actors on when I gave it out to A24 and got them on board. But I do remember well when I left that he really responded to the script, and he also was like, you know, it's funny, my wife and I, every time we'd watch a film and that we'd love it, we started realizing that it was the same logo in front of it. And so I know that that was the first time that I also got an indication of A24 being a real help besides financing the film. Just they had already kind of created something, you know, a name for themselves that they've only gone stronger in since.
I'm reminded of what you're kind of talking about there with Lulu Wang recently, where she was talking with the Farewell that, you know, she got offered this, you know, package from A24, but then there was also a company that went, hey, we will give you all this more money, we'll put it on a streaming service, but she opted for sort of the smaller package with A24. What's the kind of its reputation amongst filmmakers and talent like yourself, where people are saying no to perhaps larger money and different options to stay with something a bit more boutique potentially?
It's just a sense of people, like, I mean, even with these big companies, you're talking to good people, you're talking to people with good intentions and people that are real lovers of films, and they hopefully a lover of whatever film you're talking to them about potentially. It just comes down to whether they actually have the final say over things. Like, how long will they be there? You don't know. You don't know ultimately who's going to be in control of the final choices. There's a precedent, there's protocol, there's all these things that comes with a company that you don't know. And I know that people have had incredible, great experiences with streaming companies. But in this case with A24, what really resonated was that I was talking to the people that made the top choices of this year, and they were saying, we support this, we want you to make your film, and we're behind it. We're behind the film that you make. You know, we don't have an other idea of what potentially it could be. And it was based on them caring about the work that I had done already. And I think the fact that that wasn't commercially successful work, and they were still feeling that way, just kind of gave me extra confidence that they weren't seeing the lover as like a potentially something so different than what I'd done. This would be a breakout, you know, commercial success. It really... But for me, again, it just came down to that exact thing, which was like going back, okay, who will give me a final cut? And everybody had different reactions on how that would happen in A24 took like a minute. And we're like, yeah, that's yours. Like, that's not a thing for us, you know, at least with the scale film. And that made things much rather. I mean, it was a small film. I didn't need actually more money. I mean, I love to have my crew and to have been paid more, all that. But that, as soon as I'm making the film that I wanted, that wasn't necessary.
One of my favorite parts of this movie was the casting. You've got Tracy Letts, who'd go obviously to appear in A24's Lady Bird, Deborah Winger, Aidan Gillen, with his Irish accent of all things as well, and a huge shout out to casting Melora Walters, who I love in Magnolia, and was so excited when she popped up on this. What was your casting process like for this film?
Well, yeah, and that was another thing that I got to say with A24, is that when I did tell them, like, I actually wrote this with Deborah Winger in mind, they just were so excited, and they were just—they saw the same thing that you did, like, which was just like, well, that's an unbelievable talent that she winds up responding. That would attract, you know, the level of talent. One really started with her. It really, you know, I wrote with her. She's sending different things to her throughout the year. She'd always passed on. I mean, she sent me a very nice letter after seeing Terry. And that stayed with me. And so I'd work on something, I'd send it to her. For whatever reason, it wouldn't be the right thing. But I did write Mama's Man. I did write The Lovers, thinking of her throughout and with hopes that she would say yes, but with no guarantee. But luckily, after 24, I sent it to her. We met. And I worked with my casting director, Nicole Busto, who I've been working with again since Terry. So really everything Terry, Doll and M. And now The Lovers, and it was her idea to with Tracy Letts, and it was her idea with Melora, and Melora, especially in Magnolia, that's a character in a film that plays in a loop in my head. Like, that's a film that I can just keep on chasing. And so when I had the exact same response as you did when Nicole mentioned Melora as the role of Lucy. I just, from that moment, I send it to her, and I was just on pins and needles, because suddenly there was nobody else for this part than Melora. And I remember us meeting for the first time, and she came in as Lucy. She understood Lucy. She showed me Lucy. She dressed like Lucy. It was right there. I mean, it was just incredible. And then the same thing with Tracy. It was one of those, like, where we had a conversation, we talked, he was in Chicago, I was here in Los Angeles. We had this positive response to the script, and we had a long talk for a while about different things. And then at the end, where usually I'm kind of used to an actor going, okay, well, this is a, you know, this was a good conversation. Let me think about it for a minute, and I'll get back to you. I'm just gonna feel things out. Instead, Tracy was like, well, this sounds really good. Let's push this ball forward. I was kind of like, you know, I'm just not used to being somebody and being that forthcoming and ready to commit that quickly. But he was, and it just, I really felt like that's how the whole casting kind of went in a really, really smooth way. So it went, I believe it went from Deborah, then to Tracy, then Melora, and then I spoke to Aidan, and he was in Ireland. We were Skyping. I was very obsessed with Roy Anderson's films, who had been kind of just recently, a recent discovery for me. And as I'm talking about them and their influence on potentially on The Lovers, Aidan just reached, while we're on Skype, he reached out to his desk to pull out that he had the Roy Anderson, one of the, I forgot which one, on his desk, and that he had just been watching as well. So it just felt like a perfect sync at that moment.
Did the characters or the script kind of change much once the casting had been complete? Did any of them come to you with any sort of ideas, suggestions, or experiences for their characters, or was sort of the script God?
Yeah, in this case, oddly, and this is not something that I would have dictated, but nobody had issues with the script. Like, people were very happy with the script. And so that wasn't something where the discussions were shifting anything in the script. We definitely had discussions about things in between, what happened in between these moments, where are these lines coming from, where are these actions coming from. That was where the space was, in terms of, and then very much the way that I shoot is I try to bring in the actors before any kind of go on whatever scene that we're about to do and get a sense of how they're going to put, where are they going to sit, where does it feel right for them to stand and walk out, and what are the, you know, the emotions that are happening. But really the conversations that happened before shooting wasn't about tweaking any dialogue or changing or losing any scenes. It was really just the idea of those things of where's the ground here? Where is this coming from? And usually they're questions. They're not things that they're asking, like for me at least, that we're looking for an answer so much, other than that these are questions. Let's hold on to these questions while shooting.
How much of your direction is dictated by the tempo of their performances, or are their performances dictated by you?
I would say that I'm completely dictated by their performances. I don't know what they would say, but I feel their rhythms, and then I try to respond to them. And I definitely think Toby's the cinematographer, like we're all just kind of, I'm putting them in the lead. I mean, definitely in every film, but especially with The Lovers, so much of the time I'm looking at these actors, these incredible actors doing incredible things, and I'm just kind of in awe. My mouth is open and I'm following them. I really feel like, okay, they've taken what I've done and now they are this, and now they are being honest to it. And for me, that's where things fall back into the documentary feel of filmmaking, because we have these guidelines, we have these scenes, but I'm really looking for what are they doing that I didn't expect, and how to make sure that we're capturing that.
One of my favorite parts of the film was the score by Mandy Hoffman. It felt like a character in the film too, which it can be too rare these days. How important was the score for you? And obviously you've mentioned you've sort of been long-term collaborators now. And what was the process between you as a director and her as the composer for the tone of it?
I definitely was very early on, even in the writing of the script. I think part of the fun for me was feeling like I was writing a film from a schoolboy comedy to a certain degree, you know, from like the, maybe from the 30s. I mean, it was a lot easier for me to try to picture actors, even though I was writing with Deborah Winger. It was a lot easier for me to picture actors that I could never cast. Like, it's kind of like a tool I now do when I'm writing, actors that just aren't around, you know. So when I was thinking about Myrna Loy or William Powell while writing Lovers, I definitely felt this influence of a lot of those films that I talked about being raised with. But I didn't think like, okay, that's the soundtrack that I want to go for either. I felt in some ways I was pushing against those movies. I was trying to see what happens in between when one of those ends and now we're going to take it up. Like, so, you know, these people have found these romances with other people. Okay, what happens after that movie ends? And now we cut back into it when those romances are turned into what they've now become, which is just a total weight and a drag in so many ways. So I thought I was pushing against that, and maybe when I realized, when I talked to Mandy, I didn't have any indication of where the music was going to go writing wise or when I was shooting. It was really during the editing with Darren Navarro that I started seeing, oh yeah, the footage is pushing against, it's pushing against that story, the kind of romantic, the romantic comedy, enough that it could be a really good contrast to the music of those films. And so we started kind of just temping out some music from that era with the scenes that we had. And for me, that clash was something that got extremely exciting to me. I said, oh, all right, there's a whole, like you said, there's another character unexplored, which is the romantic music that's going on inside of them, that we've been raised with, that we hear when we're falling in love, that just, even no matter how complicated things are, there's this soundtrack that I think a lot of us feel is going on in these heightened moments. And so it was with that in mind, seeing that contrast, that I wound up talking to Mandy about some of the influences and talking about, actually, you know, we've been doing these very, very small piano-based scores. I'm thinking about something much bigger, and not only much bigger and very different than what we've done, because the piano winds up being such a key part of the story, I want to do something without piano at all, which really opened the floor up. Suddenly our bass, which was just the way that Manny and I always worked, which is just send me the piano first and we'll build out from there. We'll see if something needs to be added on. Suddenly we didn't have that. And Mandy was able to run with it and just turn in something just so beautiful and beyond anything I could have expected, but what I hoped for.
One of my favorite moments in the film, and I'm sure it's the same for many, is when Lucy hisses at Mary. How did that whole scene come around, and what was the process behind that?
It was one of those scenes that I've been carrying around, I think, since I was around 17 years old. Two mutual friends were having issues over the same lover, and one of them told me, "Hey, you know, your friend, I was walking by her, just hissed at me in the hall." And I just thought that was incredible. I mean, that, talk about cutting to the bone, like just going straight to the issue. And I've been carrying that moment around since I was 17, you know, so for a good, you know, almost 35 years, I've been walking around trying to figure out when was that going to show up? And somehow it just emerged while writing. It wasn't something I intended, but there it was. And it came up, and then that's really how it happened. And there's a few scenes like that, that the script of the lovers was able to excise some things I've been carrying around for many, many, many years, including the, It Must Be Love being played at the end. It was something that I witnessed another friend do a good 25 years earlier, just play on the piano in a much slower, sad way. But I've been curious of when, or hoping to someday be able to find a story to show that.
Once the film's completed and it's ready to be sent out into the world, like, obviously A24 has this reputation for its marketing and release strategy. What was it like for the lovers? How did you get much involvement in sort of how it's marketed and released, or is it very much in their hands after?
So much involvement. I'm so thankful. They let me be as involved as I wanted to be, which I cannot tell you was such a blessing. I mean, it was so painful. I mean, I really was not happy the way that Terry was marketed. I was very much just like, you know, you just kind of, I felt in different ways. Well, you're the filmmaker. You do your thing. We do our thing, and just stay out of this, which is just doesn't make any sense, because, well, I know they've been working in a different way than I've been working on things. Like, it just not to be heard is so frustrated. But with A24's case, I felt really the opposite. I felt completely part of the conversation, and even if we differed on some things, I always felt very, like, respected and very heard. We talked very early on that let's not, since this already has a distribution, a plan and company and a great company behind it, let's not go the festival way with this. Let's not apply to Sundance. Let's go straight to theaters with this, and not do the kind of year or potentially year of promotions, which was something that I brought up to them, and they were keen. They were up to that idea. They liked that idea. I didn't know what I've had, Sundance has been a wonderful festival to me, and a bunch of festivals have been great to me, but in this case I didn't know what it was going to bring, how it was going to help, because usually I would show it at Sundance to try to attract an A24, to try to build the kind of hype that A24 was already great at doing on their own. And so they were game for that. We picked our date of the release, which I think was May 5th here in the States. Right around that time, they came to me and said, you know, actually, the Tribeca Film Festival is like a day before that release date, a couple of days, I think it'd be worth showing it to them. I think it'd be great to kind of use whatever they're going to have to kind of add to the release. So it would screen for the first time a couple of days beforehand, and which I thought, like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, that's a good, that made sense in terms of how a festival could help this film. And Tribeca luckily responded enough to the film that they were excited to premiere it. It was a much wider release than I've ever experienced. You know, I wound up going to 440 theaters. They were just great. I mean, you know all this, but, you know, they really understood that this is a very different audience than some of their other films. I thought that they were really precise about how to get it to the audience that they thought was right for it, that they thought the audience that would turn up for it. The film in a weird way it's so not like a lot of the other films, any of their films are really connected, but I would say it really pops in a lot of ways. It just being, I'm not exactly sure which way, but I definitely felt like they had to decide, okay, see what the audience that was responding and how can we pinpoint this audience? How can we get it to them? And we opened up, we started very early on getting some very good reviews. And then as it was opening up, we got a really bad review in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And then a really great review in the LA Times and other, like, you know, a bunch of other papers. And so what usually happens with something like that is that distributors get scared and they start shifting things and they start changing things. And that was not the case at all with A24. So our opening weekend and opening week was really strong in LA, was kind of softer in New York. And they stuck to the plan, and bit by bit, New York wound up getting stronger and building. And, you know, I don't consider financial success the bar of, like, oh, that's a successful film or not. But in terms of any of my work, it's the first film that turned a profit, that made back more, a few times, ultimately with the world sales and all that, a few times what the budget was. I never had that experience before.
I don't know if you've got it in America, but I'm reminded of a phrase we have here in the UK. They call it the grey pound, that if you make a film about people that are older lovers, older stories, that older audience will come see a film. And it is such a hard thing to tap into sort of that market to get that older person along to the cinema. Do you think that, as you were saying, this isn't sort of maybe your typical A24 movie in terms of audience that might go along to it, but do you think it actually brought along a new audience in terms of the older one?
I will tell you that when I did go into the theaters and I did do some Q&As at theater, it definitely was an older audience than I've had for my work before and that I'm used to seeing. But they, and I think they're really, a lot of them were really drawn by Deborah being in the film. For the most part, it was really receptive, and I felt like they felt really spoken to. And, you know, there's something that comes with getting older where it's harder to look back with so much judgment at different relationships and question why a relationship works and doesn't work. And just realize that even the most successful relationships they're complicated. Everything is complicated and everything is kind of simple in retrospect. So I felt like, yes, they responded to having a film being brought out for them, being available to an older audience, and that they ultimately were hungry for it. And A24 was able to recognize that somehow and then get it to them. It obviously is like a very different way of getting Green Room out, or, you know, it's a different audience. But they were, the way that, you know, how personal I approach it is definitely the way that I felt that they approach this film as well. which was Care. And it's not really to put down other companies, because I think again, it's like you talk to those people with other companies, and they want the best for your work. They want it to reach an audience, but maybe it was small enough and streamlined enough, and people were just trusted enough in ways that I found really surprising and really wonderful.
Do you find that sort of, you mentioned sort of that when you see the A24 logo at the start of the film, do you find that your audience, that this film doesn't just bring in, say, an older audience as well, but brings in an audience that might not be the sort of person that goes to see a Lovers because they're maybe someone that's working their way through the A24 filmography, or they're someone that goes, oh, I really like their Western films or their films about Moonlight, for example. I'm going to check out this film, Lovers, just because it's made by this company, and then being surprised and caught by your film.
Absolutely, and I'm sure caught for both sides. You know, I'm sure just like, you know, it's a film that some people really dislike, and some people like, you know, and some people respond to, and that's been pretty much the case with all my work, and something I'm actually quite okay with and proud of in certain ways. But I think that, you know, that's absolutely the case. And I also think that if you look at the films, and obviously I haven't seen everything that A24 has put out, but there is a theme between everything. And I think it's for what I guess is that this is their things that they like, that they want to put out in the world, something that they feel connected to. And this happened to me at some of the best film festivals as well, where I realized after like popping into random films, like, okay, yes, these are film festivals that invited a bunch of films, but there is a connection between our work and they're kind of making this incredible mixtape, right? And that we can't fully see just by going to one film or the other. And I have a feeling that A24 is doing something, whether they are conscious of it or not, but ultimately there really is a connection between this work. What exactly that is, I think is up for us to walk away and decide.
How do you sort of feel as a filmmaker to have a film within their filmography of releases now, but kind of most importantly, you're sort of a select breed, that you're amongst films like Lady Bird, Moonlight, Hereditary, now Midsommar out this week, for example, that are films that they've invested in from the start, that they've seen you in the most earliest form and went, we want to invest in that. How does that feel as a filmmaker?
It feels great. It feels, it's something that, you know, you're telling yourself a lot of times, especially when you're making films that aren't super popular, that you have to kind of keep telling yourself that this is worthy, that this is worthy to others, and this is worthy to yourself, that this means something. And so having a company, having people, because I don't think so much of, even though I understand they are a company, I think of individuals when I think of A24. I think of it's one of those things that make it, especially on days where things feel tough and challenging, it's something that I can go back to and hold on to and think like, okay, others have seen it. I could keep moving forward. It's a vote. It's a flag saying to keep going.
Do you have a favorite film within their filmography, one that you particularly love, or is there a couple that really stand out for you?
Well, I had the luck to just watch The Farewell last week, and that I actually just saw The Green Room for the first time, and that had me on the story. That I think the ghost story is pretty much a perfect movie. I've already apologized to Ari, asked her about this, but I've been too afraid to watch Hereditary, but I'm planning on it. And I definitely want to see the most recent one as well. But yeah, there's a lot of them. Lady Bird, I mean, obviously Moonlight, like these are all films that I really find have been important, and just so happy that they exist and have found a place in the world.
And what's next for yourself? Have you got any sort of films that you're working on the horizon? I was highly amused. I saw a tweet. I don't know if you've seen it on Twitter, but I typed in your name to Twitter, and then it pops up of Avengers Endgame, Michelle Pfeiffer to star in dark comedy French exit from Lover's director and the sister's brother's author. And it's just like people underneath are like, that is the headline you've gone with. Michelle Pfeiffer with such an amazing career. You've gone with Avengers Endgame, where she's in it for two seconds to get a click. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but I felt the need to share that with you.
Yeah, that's good. I pursued her because of other films than those. But I'm one of those filmmakers that I'm very hesitant to talk about something that I haven't made. I could tell you that I'm deep in preparation to making a film called French Exit, which is based on a book of the same name that was written by Patrick DeWitt, who also wrote Terry and also wrote Sister's Brothers, which the book of it, which came out as a movie last year. He's one of my closest friends, so he shared it at a very early draft of the book, and we've been working on bringing this forward for a while now. And I've cast Michelle Pfeiffer as Frances, the mother, and her son will be played by Lucas Hedges. And we're in the midst of casting right now and doing all the preparation to make it. And it's a very, very different film than The Lovers, and I think from everything else that I made, which is a lot of the attraction for me, something that I'm extremely excited and hopeful about.
I'm really excited to see this one. I'm keen to dive into your filmography and check out even more of your original work and maybe revisit Doll and Emma. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you giving up so much of your time to talk about your career, your work on The Lovers and A24. It really means a lot. So thank you very much. And if kind of people wanted to check out maybe some of your work or find your website, where could kind of people seek that out?
Yes, I've been putting, what I've been up to most recently on a website called TalkiesInc.com. And hopefully Terry and Dolan M is available out in the EU or, you know, where you are in the UK and everywhere around there on iTunes. And I believe it should be. And Mama's Man, I don't know if it's there, but I'm working on relicensing right now because it expired, so that should be available in the next few months.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, and people can find all those in the show notes. So yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate this.
Of course, thank you. Yeah, no, I have as well, and best of luck ahead.